Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Mike Edison, host of Art Senses a Seizure, as you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, please visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, this is Joshua David Stein of the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour. The reason I call it that is because it's only half an hour, but it is various. Today we're going to be talking about the various ways that restaurants communicate about themselves, maybe in ways that they don't know that they're communicating. You know, there's a lot that they go through to get their ideas across. The chef goes through to get his philosophies of food across, ways that they mean to communicate it, and then there's a layer of what they actually communicate. Sometimes it overlaps, hopefully often, and then there's also this sort of buffer where they're communicating things that maybe they don't know that they're communicating. Recently for the New York Observer, I reviewed a restaurant called Almanac in the West Village. It's a fine dining restaurant. The chef is Galen Zamara, and it's not bad. The food is actually pretty good, but I think in terms of how it communicates or what it tries to communicate, there's a lot to be desired. And I think one reason that I've been thinking about that is because I've been reading a book called The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads a Menu by Dan Jurafsky, a linguist at Stanford, who I believe is on the line. Dan, are you there?
I am, Joshua. Thanks so much for having me.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
So the first chapter of your book, which for me, reading the first chapter of your book was realizing that someone has written everything I've ever wanted to write about restaurant menus, backed up by empirical evidence. In your book, you talk about the inverse relationship between choice and sort of price. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, everyone has, and you pointed this out in your review, everybody has this instinct that when you go to a fancy restaurant, often you get these tasting menus where the chef tells you what to eat. And what we found is you can find subtle cues about this kind of tendency on all sorts of menus by looking at the words. That's kind of the thing. I'm a linguist, and so we look at words. So, you know, for example, we found that the cheaper the restaurant, the more they use the word you, or words related to choice. So, you know, inexpensive restaurants, your diners, are going to say things like your way or any way you like them or your choice, or talk about your choice of, you know, shrimp or chicken or something. Whereas your expensive restaurants, it's really all about the chef, and sure enough, the word chef or chef selection or tasting menu is going to be much more frequent on those kind of menus. So you can just see it by counting the words.
I thought that was a very interesting point, and one that I had a couple of thoughts about, which we'll get to. There's a term you use in that first chapter, which I think is so interesting, which is you talk about in another instance where restaurants that say, what sort of restaurants use the words delicious and appetizing and fresh and real. And I'm blanking on the name of the theory, but it's where no one uses words when you don't have to. So if you're
right,
saying something,
I was probably talking about Grice, the philosopher, the linguistic philosopher, who said that you know, people are, and sort of linguists believe this in general, people are sensible or rational or he called it cooperative in their use of language. People say things for a reason. If I'm talking to you and I'm using a word, I'm using the word because I want to communicate an idea to you, or maybe I'm communicating my status or communicating something about our relationship with each other. Words are communicative, and so you don't say things for no reason whatsoever.
So when a restaurant says, you know, genuine crab meat, you're saying that the implication is they're pushing back maybe against a thought that maybe it isn't genuine.
Exactly, exactly. Why would a restaurant say, you know, real crab or I don't know, real whipped cream, or even like on a really bad day, like real mashed potatoes? You know, the implication is that there's an alternative to real mashed potatoes, which is fake mashed potatoes. And if they have to tell you that the potatoes are real, the only sensible reason to tell you that is because you didn't know that already. Well, if you didn't know it already, then the restaurant can't be very good if you weren't even positive the potatoes were going to be real potatoes.
Right. I love that point. I think how it applies to Chef's Choice. As a critic, you know, I eat at, you know, pretty high-end restaurants, also within a very limited population, New York City. I would say that in my experience, because I was thinking about it after I read your book, in my experience, the higher the end restaurant, the higher end the restaurant, I don't see the chef's, I don't see anything that says chef's choice or the chef's way. Mostly exactly because of that point, there's no need to say that because it's already implied. You know what I mean?
Yes, although even the menu you mailed me, so we're looking at the menu for Almanac.
Yeah, which I'll describe in a sec. Go on, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you're right in one sense. So the way that they don't say a chef selection, they say tasting menu. So they give you a three-course tasting menu or a five-course or an eight-course. But on that menu, there's the word chef. The name of the chef is there. The name of the chef de cuisine is there. The name of the pastry chef is there. And that's so even the fancy restaurants, here's a pretty fancy restaurant, and the word chef is there. Now, the maybe the very fanciest restaurants these days, you know, there's no menu at all. The fanciest restaurants, I went to a Michelin star restaurant in San Francisco, and they have no menu. The waiter told me about the food, and then I kind of begged for a menu, and they very graciously emailed me a PDF, you know, the next evening, but there was no menu.
What I love about that is going back to not saying anything that you needn't say. It kind of harkens back to the origins of a menu and what it meant as a bill of fare in kind of these, what you write about as public-private spaces, these restaurants.
Exactly, exactly. People would go to these fancy dinners in the early, you know, early modern periods, in the, you know, relatively recently, 1700s, 1800s, and we shifted in these fancy European meals from having all the food laid out on the table, maybe in two big meta courses. So the food's covered in different courses, and sort of your servant would grab you what you wanted, to this modern style of coursed meals. And when that happened, people began to get a little list of food next to their plate, saying what the next course was going to be, so you had an idea how to save your appetite. And that, you know, generalized into our modern menu. But you think about it, for a long time there were no written menus. You know, the waiter told you what, you know, that you go to a tavern and you ask them what they have that day, and they tell you.
What's so hilarious to me is that now we've come, it's not full circle, but we've come back to when you go to a super high-end place, there are also no menus. And it's not, and I think embedded in that dynamic is a change in the power structure, right? Like now when you go to a Per Se, or I don't know where you went in San Francisco. Where did you go in
Saison? I went to Saison.
Saison. Yeah. It's like you are sort of a diner going in is sort of a supplicant in the altar of haute cuisine, right? And you go in and you sort of abdicate. What you're paying for is the experience of abdication of will, sort of, or like,
yeah,
agency.
I mean, the way I look at it these days is I think about it like theater. You know, you don't, if you're going to go to the theater, you don't write, you know, look up on the web and read, the, you know, ask the playwright to send you the text of the play in advance so you can check if you like the play. Well, maybe you read a survey or a review, but you're trusting the playwright to do his job or her job for you and give you something, you know, well-written, and you're trusting the actress to deliver it. And that's kind of what fancy restaurants, they're in an entertainment. You know, the cheap restaurants, well, that's, you know, you're at work, you need lunch. That's the job of those restaurants, to feed you day to day. And then your choice matters. These fancy places, really, it's theater.
Yeah. And I think part of it is, and that's one of my problems, I think, with Almanac, is I was reading your books. I was thinking about what is communicated about a restaurant besides just what's coming out of the kitchen by a menu. And I thought the idea that you can have a three-course tasting menu, a five-course, and then an eight-course, which is the case at Almanac, But then you can choose, you can mix and match from either of those courses, or just order a la carte as a sort of taken as a piece of theater. It's confusing, right?
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, either you put yourself in the chef's hands or you don't. But if you can order each dish, yeah, what's the message we're saying? Are we a lower-priced restaurant where the diner is king and the diner has choice, or are we a theater where you don't pick things that way, and you're saying that they're giving you a mixed message?
Exactly. You also bring up some amazing sort of like data points. One of them has to do with the length of syllables and the cost of a dish. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Facts about the menu that tell you something about the price. So we talked about the word "you" on the cheaper menus. So another one is
"yuzu."
It's just length of the word. So if you just measure the word in letters and say how long is the average word on this menu, you can predict the price of an individual dish on the menu just by looking at the length of the average word. So every additional letter in the average word length increases the price of the dish 18 cents.
Which is amazing.
You can see that. I mean, 18 cents, not a lot of money. Obviously, there's lots of other factors that are even better predictors of the restaurant being expensive. But the fact that word length is there means that either consciously or maybe subconsciously, you know, menu writers are sort of manipulating their language. And one thing they do that plays a role in that is the more expensive menus these days, they just leave off all the small words.
Right.
So if you look at the Almanac menu, what expensive menus do these days is they give you the name of a dish, and then they give you a list of ingredients with commas. Sometimes not even a comma, just a space. But not the word "and," not the word "with."
You're going syllable per word, not total syllable, right?
Pardon?
You're going syllable per word, not total syllable.
Right, exactly right. So the total length of the menu, now that correlates inversely with price. So, you know, it's your Greek diners or your Chinese restaurants. Those have very long menus, lots of words, lots of dishes. But it's the length of the individual word, how big are the words they're using on average.
Right.
So it's the average word length. That's the one that goes linearly with price. The expensive restaurants have short menus with long words.
Right. So if there's there's a menu and it had one dish and it was like supercalifragilisticexpialidocious chicken.
Exactly.
It would be the most expensive restaurant in New York.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The most expensive restaurant would have no words. So
right.
They're the mathematics breaks.
The ineffable menu.
Exactly.
I'm just curious. How did you get into looking at menus as a site for linguistic study?
Well,
you live in Palo Alto?
I've been teaching this, you know, these days in college. You know, classes, big lecture classes are big, so all the universities are trying to find ways to get freshmen how to learn how to do research, how to learn to think critically with a small class. And so we're always trying to come up with clever small classes that will get students into our topics but be fun. And so how to get students into linguistics, I like food, I'm interested in the history of food words and food use, and so I created this little seminar called The Language of Food, and you know, this generation of college students, they're very foodie in a way that, I don't know, my generation wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So it really appeals to them, and I got some great students who got interested in all sorts of good topics, and then it was with a collaboration with some friends of mine at Carnegie Mellon, who they had thought about looking at menus, and so I started working with them on menus, and it's been great.
Yeah, the menu, what I like about your book is it tackles a bunch of different sort of, I guess, areas of food, from like ketchup and ceviche and where that came from. But really, as a restaurant critic, someone who's going to, you know, restaurants as opposed to cooking at home or looking at it from a culinary perspective, what's so interesting to me is even though ketchup holds within it a whole bunch of history, a menu is a created thing. So there's like also marketing and clearly the establishment is trying to tell you something about themselves. And I'm not even sure they're conscious of how if they know what tools are using to tell themselves about them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think the most the big chain restaurants clearly do. They're hiring marketing people. I've talked to people at who run very, very high-end restaurants, and they say yes, they call in designers So they're, you know, they can afford to do that kind of thing, and they have to for their kind of clientele. They have to be very professional. So they hire Madison Avenue. They know what they're doing. Really, a menu is a kind of advertising. It's a really great kind of advertising because your customers are forced to read that advertising in order to get what they want. So you know, a menu is like a dream product for an advertising person. But you can see it, really, the language of food. You know, I've been looking at reviews a lot as well, like just Yelp reviews, just right. Amateur people reviewing. And there's so much you can learn about people and about how we think and about our attitude toward each other just by looking at the words in reviews. So it's not just history or it's not just advertising. Really, food words tell you a lot about everything.
Before you go, tell us a little bit about your work with Yelp, which I find fascinating.
Oh, this is so great. So, for example, you might imagine that when you read a Yelp review about a restaurant, if it's a one-star review, the diner hated the restaurant, it would be talking about bad food. But in fact, these one-star reviews, what they use instead is the language of trauma. They use precisely the same words that people who are writing about tragedies and traumas, people dying, like, say, in 9/11, when people blogging after 9/11, they used a particular kind of language, and we find that kind of language in these one-star reviews.
What's an example of that?
So some things you might expect. They use bad words like terrible and horrible, but they also use distancing language.
Linguistic blanching.
They put things in the past.
Is that linguistic blanching?
No, linguistic bleaching is when a word has a meaning, and then over time that meaning kind of bleaches away. So, for example, the word sauce or the word salsa comes from the Latin word sal for salt. So those used to just mean salt.
Oh.
So they were ways of – and now now they don't really mean salt. They've kind of generalized their meaning to mean some kind of savory addition.
Oh, right. I thought you had written in the book about, like, terrible and awful –
You're so right. Yes, you're absolutely right. So, yes, the word awful has been bleached. You're absolutely right. So, you know, awful used to mean something that caused awe, and terrible was something that caused terror. And over time, those bleach, and so and now they just mean bad in some undefinable way.
In a Yelp one-star way.
And we see those, and we see in a one-star way, and we see those in the one-star restaurants. But the thing that looks so much like trauma is that they write in the past tense to distance themselves, and they use a ton of first-person plural pronouns. They use the word we, they use the word us, the word our. And when people are writing after trauma, it seems like they use those words because this bad thing happened, and they're trying to take solace in the collective. Like, this bad thing happened, but it happened to me and my family, so we're going to get through it as a group together. And it seems like that's what's going on in the reviews. They don't say, you know, the waitress yelled at me, or I won't go back. They say, we were ignored, the waitress yelled at us, we won't go back. So this bad thing happened.
But and in five-star reviews? Or
the five-star reviews, totally different. So now if you like a five-star restaurant, you talk about sex. So you say, if you like a restaurant, five-star review, and it's expensive, you talk about sex. So you talk about orgasmic pastry or very naughty deep-fried pork belly. But if you
can
really
I just
like
interject that that's like the
review,
worst fucking food writing I've ever like. I hate using sex as a crutch for talking about high.
Yeah, you're
food.
A professional. Yeah, your job is to be interesting. I mean, right? You're giving us theater. That's what you're doing in those reviews.
Right, but so you're saying the civilian population, when they love a restaurant high end, they talk about sex, and in the first person singular.
More first-person singular than if they don't like a restaurant, yes.
Okay. And if it's low-end?
And low-end, they talk about drugs. So they say the wings are addicting or the chocolate in their cookies has crack in it. They talk about craving the food. So they're using the language of addiction and drugs as if they're embarrassed. You know, we know this, you know, this unhealthy food, this chocolate and these chicken wings and the French fries. We're embarrassed by eating them, and we're sort of, putting the responsibility for the fact that we're eating it on this food as drug that kind of forces us to eat it. It's like the cupcake forced itself down my throat. I had no choice.
Right. Dan, I feel like I could talk about this for hours more, and I hope to have you again on the program. The book is The Language of Food. It is the best food book I think I've ever read. It gets at everything I've always wanted to write as a critic. So thank you so much for writing it, and thank you for being a guest on the show, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
We'll be right back after a short break.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Severa Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
Now it's time for a musical guest who's gonna sing a song or two.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Richard Miller. Thank you. That was wonderful, Richard.
Thank you.
I think that if our listeners were wondering, where's that music from? I don't think a lot of them would say Brazil. But tell me about that piece.
This is a tune called Vê Se Gostas, which means see if you like it. And it is from Brazil.
But I wanted to ask you, kind of as part of a continuation of the first conversation, is here in America, I feel like Brazilian music is really maybe really one song, right? Girl from Ipanema, where if you go into any restaurant, which is at all like sexy or cool, you'll have that song playing. And then that's automatically how you know that you're in a cool place, you know, in like a sexy vibe.
Yes.
But you've spent your career and your work exploring the other forms of Brazilian music. So that piece was choro, right?
Choro, yeah.
And what is choro?
Choro is similar to American ragtime. I call it Brazilian ragtime. And it developed around the same time, and it was instrumental and very fast and fun, and it was a mixture of African and European cultures, much like ragtime.
And how did Girl from Ipanema, which is kind of samba,
Bossa Nova,
yeah. How did that just erase everything else in that musical culture?
Well, I don't think it erased everything. I just think it had such a huge projection worldwide,
right,
that it may have eclipsed a lot of other Brazilian music. But I think that there is a reason for that. I think Jobim got the best of Brazil's musical language and combined it all into a beautiful art form. And so a song like Girl from Ipanema has a beautiful melody with beautiful jazz harmonies and sensuous rhythms, African rhythms. And then the lyrics are great, too.
Right.
So it just combines everything.
We had talked about it earlier before the show, but could you go through very quickly and say, okay, choro,
uh-huh.
Forró, bossa nova, just a quick rhythm, and then is there something called pagode?
Pagode, yeah.
Yeah, pagode. Just real quick, so someone can hear, if this is one riff done like five ways, this is what it might sound like.
Okay. Well, if you really want to go in depth, then look me up and you can take some guitar lessons from me.
Where do you teach?
Well, you can go to my website, which is balancedguitar.com.
Okay.
But basically, the Brazilian music is a mixture of cultures. And so if you go all the way back to the 1870s, what they were mixing was an African dance called lundu with the polka. And that gave, the polka goes, and then they took the pa out and they inserted an African rhythm and it became... And that's an early choro rhythm called the mashishi.
Okay.
And then mashishi developed into samba. And samba is basically, I'll play the same two chords. And then this great guitarist named João Gilberto came along, and he made that two-measure pattern into one measure, and he added seventh chords.
The magical seven.
Yeah. And became still the same root, but a different pattern, and it was much slower. So...
That's when we get into the Jobim territory.
Yeah, that's Jobim territory. And I was playing the chords from Girl from Ipanema. And I've played in many restaurants, and you see the Girl from Ipanema look on the eyes of customers when they walk up to the bandstand, and you know they're going to ask for Girl from Ipanema. And they always do. So it's not the musician's fault.
Right. They're just playing what they're told to play.
You are also...
Wait. I still have a couple
more. Oh, sorry.
More
go on. Go on. Yeah.
So there's Fahaw, right. Which is various rhythms in itself, but the most prominent one is the Bayong, which places that rhythm in the lower part, the African rhythm I was talking about, in the lower part of the accompaniment. And so... that kind mm-hmm. of... and then Pagwaji is a form of samba.
Okay.
So the rhythm would be the same. There's hundreds of Brazilian rhythms, and so.
Right. Yeah. And you are also, you were saying before that you're leading a pretty amazing-sounding retreat down to Costa Rica. It's surfing, guitar, and yoga, and it's based around this one steel foundry worker. Is that the...
That's right, yeah.
Tell me about that real quick.
Well, there was this great guitarist that everybody loves. His name is João Pernambuco. And he was...
When was he active?
He moved from the state of Pernambuco in Brazil to Rio around 1903, 1904, looking for work. And he found work in a steel foundry. And his friends quickly realized what a talent he was on the guitar. And so they took a stand for him to get out of such a dangerous job working in a steel foundry where at any minute he could burn his hands off. And so they got him a job laying cobblestones in the streets of Rio. And as a,
which are beautiful, if I remember, right? They're black and white and sort of in crescent shapes.
Right. You're thinking of the Copacabana Beach sidewalk. Yeah. And so it was heavy labor, but it saved his hands. And he had huge influence on all of Brazilian music, even the music of Villa-Lobos and classical performers, composers. And what I'm doing is I'm taking a stand for my guitar students to make sure that they don't injure themselves by practicing in an unbalanced way and by getting out of shape and overusing small muscles. And so I'm taking a group of students to Costa Rica to teach them how to surf so that they get the exercise of this intensive sport. And then yoga, which is balance and... stretching and injury prevention, and then we're going to have guitar class every day.
It sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
And if our listeners wanted to sign up, where would they sign up? Or is it?
It's balancedguitar.com.
There you go.
Yeah.
So what's the second song you're going to play?
I'll play you a João Pernambuco song.
Great.
And it's called Sounds of Bells. And it's in the rhythm of Maxixe that I played you first, which is a combination of polka and lundu.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And festive.
Yes.
You had one more thing that MSM wanted to...
Yeah, my alma mater, Manhattan School of Music, is celebrating the golden age of its guitar department. It was an age that I'm revealing how old I was. I am. Where I was studying there, I did my master's there, and we had the four great guitar teachers there, Manuel Barueco, Nicholas Galusis, Carlos Barbosa Lima, and Sharon Isbin, and they'll all be back on February 15th through the 17th to give concerts, master classes, and have a celebration. So we're calling all alumni and all interested people to come attend this great festival.
Okay. And you can, I'm sure you can find information out by Googling Manhattan School of Music.
Yes.
Richard, do you want to take us out on an old classic?
Yes, I'll take us out on The Girl from Ipanema. I don't, do your listeners know that you're in the middle of a restaurant?
They know, yeah. Only, so this is perfect.
Yeah. Oops. I have to
hold, please. I'd like to thank all of our guests tonight on the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, Half Hour. Dan Jurafsky from Stanford University, Richard Miller, and Liz Smith, our lovely engineer in the control room. I'll see you next week. That's it for tonight. Thank you for listening to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, Half Hour. Good night.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.